Hello, and welcome to I Am The Egg Pod with me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, it's a delight to welcome back dramatist, author, and playwright, the effulgent Dan Rebellato.
Effulgent. Thank you, Chris.
How are you?
I'm good. It's lovely having those little signs of normality at the edges of your life again, which is good. So yeah, I'm very happy at the moment.
Good, because I was thinking it was only like 6 months ago, I think, we did the last one.
That's right.
Which
is January.
Like a lifetime ago.
I know. It's that pre-COVID thing that is just like, oh yeah, that was another dimension, wasn't it?
Yeah. And the album that you've picked today is the 1973 album, Ringo. So why have you picked this one?
Well, because I really like this record. And hand on heart, I really enjoy this record. And am I right in thinking you haven't had a Ringo record yet?
No, I've been waiting, and you've finally arrived.
Well, I've broken your Ringo duck, or yeah. Taken your Ringo cherry, or whatever the most appropriate phrase is.
Please be gentle with me.
I think this is a really good record, and I don't think it's a terribly well known record because it's a Ringo Starr record. So generally. People don't really buy those, I imagine, in great numbers. But I think there's a load to recommend about it, not least of which, and of course we're going to talk about this, is it's kind of the closest thing to a Beatles reunion that we got until... Mm. In fact, I think it's even more of a Beatles reunion than the actual 1990s Beatle reunion. So, definitely. There's loads that's really interesting as well about this record.
Yeah. So this was Ringo's third album. He released a couple in 1970. In fact, Paul was the last one to release a solo album. Ringo released Sentimental Journey, which was schmaltzy covers, and the full-out country album, Beaucoups of Blues, as he pronounced it. So the forerunner to all of this, he had massive commercial success with his singles, It Don't Come Easy and Back Off Boogaloo, in 71 and 72. And there was a lot of involvement by George Harrison with the songwriting. And this is a tradition that goes back to at least 69 with Octopus's Garden, which is effectively, we can see George composing it for Ringo.
Yes, that's right. And actually, I mean, it's really interesting when I kind of dug into this bit that actually Ringo is kind of the most consistently... chart successful Beatle of the period, because apart from Beaucoups of Blues, which didn't chart at all, everything is top 10. In fact, his singles, two fantastic singles, It Don't Come Easy and Back Off Boogaloo, are both top 5 singles. Now, he doesn't release that many singles, but actually on average he's doing better than John, Paul or George, weirdly, up until this time. And as I say, I think that the fact the last two singles are genuinely really good records is kind of, it gives you a little sign that there was hope for this record, I think.
Mm, absolutely. So this was, Ringo described it as an accidental album. He attended the Grammy Awards in Nashville, where the concert for Bangladesh won the Grammy. And he was keen to actually get back and do something. So he met Richard Perry during this visit. And I think that was quite a key meeting, because Richard Perry, who's also produced Rod Stewart, Carly Simon, Harry Nilsson, notably.
And Fanny. Yeah,
that gave him the push.
Do you know Fanny? Do you know Fanny, Chris?
I'm well aware of Fanny. There was a recent cover of Mother, which I've never heard before. That's Barbara Streisand.
That was Barbara Streisand, that's right.
No, backed by Fanny.
That's right. They're great. They're a really great band.
Yeah. Oh, they're superb, yeah.
And championed, I think, by David Bowie, an all-female band, which, great thing.
And they're a nightmare to Google, This,
you don't want that in your search history.
So around this time, there was a lot of talk about Beatles reunions. So you had the Red and Blue albums out as well. Alan Klein's contract had finished. And there was a lot of press coverage. But I think basically I'm the Greatest kicked it off, which was recorded at Sunset Sound in LA. So as soon as they realised John, George and Ringo were at a recording session, all these The Beatles Are to Reform headlines appeared.
Mm. And wasn't there this... odd idea that that Klaus Voormann was going to kind of replace Paul and there'd be a sort of ersatz Beatles band. I don't really know the story behind it, but yeah, there was something about the ladders, wasn't there, that they were supposed to reform?
I think that was just an aside. I don't think it was a real plan, to be honest.
No. You can't really imagine. It would be such a weird thing to do, to reform without Paul, because also the stakes would be so high. You know, any kind of failure, it would just be in a kind of admission that Paul was really important in the band. So it's obviously a crazy idea. For me, what's kind of interesting about the idea that this is a sort of Beatles reunion, because clearly all four Beatles are on this, the same bit of plastic, together, but it's also in a way Ringo is almost the most distinctive Beatle, and that's a bit of a weird thing to say, but Paul and George are very versatile, you know, so their musical styles range all over the place. John, of course, has a very distinctive voice. Ringo has a very distinctive voice. And actually, I was thinking about Free as a Bird. Because I remember, I don't know if you remember this, but it was debuted on Radio 1 on a morning in November 95, whenever it was. And obviously I was very excited to hear it. And actually, Free as a Bird doesn't sound very like the Beatles, I don't think.
No.
Partly because, you know, George is playing slide guitar, which he really didn't do very much in the Beatles, and they've all got much older voices and that sort of thing. But the track begins with two kind of smashes on the drums from Ringo, and that is completely recognisable. He's immediately recognisable in his drumming. I don't know if you heard Jenny Lewis had an album last year. She was from Rilo Kiley, so she did a solo album. And the album's called On the Line, and there's a track in it called Head's Gonna Roll. Fantastic, fantastic track. And Ringo plays drums on it. And again, as soon as the drums come slamming in, you can just hear it's Ringo. He has a really recognisable signature on the drums. So in a sense, it feels like he's a natural centre of gravity for the kind of Beatles reunion that is sort of going on this record. But also the sort of, there's a slight sense of pastiche Beatles in places on the record.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly in the first track, obviously. But kind of elsewhere, there are these sort of little, slightly in inverted commas, nods towards the Beatles, little name checks and things like that. So in some ways, I think there's something almost logical about Ringo's first, as it were, sort of proper album that isn't those sort of slightly odd pastiche things in 1970 actually being a moment where the Beatles start to revisit the Beatles rather than what most of them were doing, is kind of like, I'm going to do as something as different from that as possible.
And he was always going to be the underdog after the split in terms of Sony America. But he, as you say, he was having the most commercial success. And I think one thing I love is that after the split, they all had their circle of friends, their new circle of friends. And there was a bit of a crossover with some of George and Ringo's friends. But on this album, you can see who his friends are. And as a lineup on an album, you've got the Beatles, the band, Harry Nilsson, Martha Reeves. It just goes on.
But the other thing, though, is that there are, you know, this is sort of a band of session musicians for quite a bit of it, but they're superior session musicians, obviously, but also they're people like Jim Keltner and Klaus Voormann and so on, who have also been playing on other Beatles records as well. So you weirdly do have this kind of crossover. There are links here that extend right through the kind of Beatles sort of family, if that's not too weird a way of saying it.
When I was a little boy, way back home in Liverpool, my mama told me I was great. Then when I was a teenager, I knew that I had got something going. All my friends told me I was great.
So let's move on to the album. And we start with track one, a John Lennon song, I'm the Greatest.
Oh, this is great, isn't it? What a fun...
Yeah.
What a brilliant way of starting this record. And as I understand it, it's quite an old John Lennon song. I think it was kind of around Plastic Ono Band, something around there anyway. And what's interesting is that you can, because I think there are recordings of John singing it, and when John sings it, it sounds much kind of more bitter and twisted, and you know, and that whole process of going through kind of what his mother said and what fans said and what his wife said still seems to be in the spirit of that kind of Arthur Yanov primal scream therapy. And you know, the line about I was in the greatest show on earth for what it's worth, of course, with Lennon, that's another I don't believe in Beatles. But when it's Ringo singing it, it's just fun. And it's a celebration of all those things rather than a kind of denunciation of them. I think partly as well because, and this is, I hope this isn't cruel to say, but if John Lennon sings I'm the Greatest, you kind of think, well, we know you're great, but you don't have to go on about it. But nobody thinks Ringo's the greatest. You know, really. So it feels like a sort of fun little bit of mock arrogance, whereas it would be arrogant for John to sing. What do you think of this song?
Oh, yeah, it's adorable. I think we'll come to it in a second. There's some definite Sergeant Pepper references here. But as you say, John wrote this and it was December 70, and it was really during and after the primal scream therapy, so it was written from that perspective. But he watched A Hard Day's Night on TV, and you can imagine John, you know, after the Beatles split, after meeting Yoko, after primal scream therapy, then him watching A Hard Day's Night, and his quote was, I'm the greatest, it's the Muhammad Ali line, but I couldn't sing it, but it was perfect for Ringo, which he said. He could say, I'm the greatest, and people wouldn't get upset. Where if I said, I'm the greatest, they'd take it all so seriously. So, yeah, I think he was well aware it had to be a Ringo song.
Yeah, and of course, he's obviously rewritten it, because as you mentioned, the Billy Shears reference to Sergeant Pepper and so on. So it has been purposed for Ringo, and the Boogaloo line as well.
Yeah.
But it feels, what I think shines out through this song and actually through the whole record is just the kind of affection that people have for Ringo. Actually, the affection that Ringo is able to inspire, because it's a record, I'll probably come back to this later, but it's a record that kind of only works if you like Ringo. And I mean, if you just like the idea of Ringo, and because we do like the idea of Ringo, and that's why the album does kind of work.
Yes, my name is Billy Shears. You know it has been for so many years. Now I'm only 32, and all I want to do is boogaloo.
It's funny, I was thinking about Lennon writing a song like this that's very self-conscious, and actually the Beatles they've often kind of done these quite self-conscious things, you know, like, I mean, you know, George Harrison was quite often autobiographical, you know, Sue You, Sue Me Blues and Apple Scruffs and stuff like that, and obviously Lennon's How Do You Sleep and those sorts of things. Paul tends not to do that in quite the same way. I think he's done it more recently, the kind of songs we were singing and that sort of thing. But it's really interesting, I think, the way that with Paul songs that are actually very specific and personal, you can still imagine them being covered. Like, you could imagine somebody covering Here Today, and it would still work as a song. You could even imagine somebody covering, you know, Lovely Linda, because it's sort of got its own melody. Whereas, surely nobody's going to cover How Do You Sleep? I mean, wouldn't that be a weird... Imagine somebody doing that.
It's weird, the two... Yeah, there's two songs. John, with I'm the Greatest, which effectively then he gave to Ringo, but the other song he wrote about Paul, How Do You Sleep, have both got Sgt. Pepper references. They've both got that audio, you know, the bed of the audience.
Yeah, that's right.
So there's something about Sgt. Pepper.
Yeah, I think, well, yeah, because it, I suppose because it was kind of Paul was really driving it. And even though, I mean, obviously John's contributions to Sgt. Pepper are sort of titanic and extraordinary, the whole idea is sort of Paul's, isn't it? The fake band. I've never understood the first line of How Do You Sleep? He says, so Sgt. Pepper took you by surprise. And you go, it didn't take Paul by surprise. It was his idea. So I'm not quite sure what he means by that.
I don't know if he's singing that to Paul or to everyone. I don't know. Yeah, I know what you mean.
Oh, it's confusing.
Because then he says, you better see right through that mother's eyes. So he's singing to us about Paul, I think, in the first couple of lines.
Oh, is that right? I thought it was through your mother's eyes. But then maybe that's just me mishearing it.
I'll edit whoever's right.
And it's also, I really love the, I think the arrangement of it is terrific. And George is very witty, I think, on this song. There are lots of little, sort of little hints of Beatles-y things. He uses there's a bit of, I think it sounds like a thing he plays in Badge by Cream. That kind of down, that thing. And, you know, he sort of builds that in. There's something that sounds a bit like All Things Must... Something of All Things Must Pass in there. So it's a lovely little sort of tissue of quotations that sort of supports this slightly sort of... As I say, it's both a kind of Beatles reunion, but also a sort of a pastiche of a Beatles reunion. There's quite a lot of pastiche, I think, on this whole record.
Yeah, that down, 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 down. It was also on 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 on Abbey Road as well. So
yeah, okay.
Maybe throwing it in there just to give a bit like When We Was Fab.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, exactly. You said Billy Preston's on this as well.
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. Is it him? So it's him playing the kind of piano, or is that John Lennon?
No, that's John on piano. He's done that quirky organ.
Oh, okay, right. Oh, that's great.
So it's almost the same lineup as the Get Back sessions.
It is, yeah.
Klaus
instead
of Paul. Huh. But I do love the audience when the, and now I'm only 32. Because he wasn't.
No, he was
And then you've got the laughter. Yeah, you've got that laughter. The same laughter you get in Sergeant Pepper.
Very good.
Which Paul always loved because he liked the idea that, like listening to the goons, you could hear the laughter and sometimes you had no idea what they were laughing at.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I love the fact that it's clearly John, George and Ringo on it, but because there's the reference to Billy Shears and to the Sergeant Pepper title track, it feels like Paul's in the mix as well.
Yeah.
Did they know that Paul was going to be on another track? Do you know?
Well, he invited all three of them.
Okay.
So we came to the UK to promote That Will Be the Day. Mm. And he said to Paul, you know, come on, all the other lads are on here. So, yeah, I think they must have known. George would have known because he was involved right from the beginning.
Yeah. Okay.
So, yeah, I think so. Track two, Have You Seen My Baby, a Randy Newman song.
Yeah, this is a really good song. It's a brilliant song, actually. It's very, it's Randy Newman, so of course it's brilliant. But, you know, the lyric is very clever and very funny and very kind of bruised. But, you know, it's a brilliant, you know, I seen her with a milkman riding down the street, and I always imagine an electric milk float.
Yeah.
You know, when you're through with my baby, milkman, send her home to me. It's such a such a wonderful lyric. He's amazing at writing. Randy Newman's so great at writing these really simple lyrics that are nonetheless very poignant or very funny. He's kind of it's very few writers, and actually I don't think any of the Beatles particularly are able to do this, who can write laugh out loud funny songs and at the same time write sumptuously beautiful ballads. It's kind of like it's like Randy Newman, like Cole Porter and Morrissey before he became a terrible racist.
Yeah.
You know, have that ability to just be incredibly funny and then soaringly emotional, or sometimes in the same song. Ringo does this really well, actually. He's not quite got, I would say, the kind of wit that Randy Newman has.
Mm.
So I sort of listened to it wondering if Ringo quite knows that it's a joke.
Mm. Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's really good, and it's a great arrangement. I think it's a better arrangement than Randy Newman's version. Actually, Randy Newman's version slightly buries the tune a bit, but Ringo actually kind of really punches that out. I think it's terrific. What about you?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, the horn arrangements by Tom Scott really, really give this some punch as well.
Mm.
And obviously on guitar we've got Mark Bolan.
I know. And when you know
King
that
of Boogie,
you can just hear at the beginning, it's the kind of get it on rhythm that he's doing. It's great. And I was thinking as well that this is another example where it's Ringo's persona that really gives you it really makes this work, because actually none of the other Beatles, I think, could have sung this. Lennon would have made it too caustic, and Paul would be too controlling, I think, for this to play the kind of everyman loser. And Harrison is kind of a bit too hot on sleeve to be able to do something like this. Whereas actually, because, you know, Ringo has that kind of Hard Day's Night kind of loner, ordinary guy persona. He makes this work really well, I think.
Yeah. I think when Randy Newman sings it, it's a very kind of world-weary, savvy, and Ringo's got a certain naivety to it.
Yeah, that's right.
Quite charming for me, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, that is one of my favourite lines. When you're through with my baby milkman, send her home to me.
Yeah. I really like that. It's a very clever, again, very clever, but very simple, that please don't talk to strangers, baby, but she always do. She says, I'll talk to strangers if I want to, because I'm a stranger too, which has that kind of Dylan-esque little kind of playfulness and mystery to it, but without trying to say anything, not trying to say anything very serious. It's just saying something about the hollowness of their relationship, which is great.
Yeah. It's for me, I mean, Boogie in itself, I think Ringo pulls it off best out of all of them. John, a lot of Boogie on Sometime in New York City.
Yeah.
Paul, I guess High, High, High was
That's right.
Boogie. But Ringo, I think Mark Bolan's involvement just pushes it to another level.
Yeah, absolutely. And it sort of really... we should say the production on this record is great, isn't it? I mean, it's really... It's kind of really meaty and kind of thick and warm. I'm making it sound like oxtail soup. I'm saying this album sounds like oxtail soup. But, you know, what...
It does.
It's got that kind of... I think you have to kind of like the 70s because it's got that... It's a very 70s album. But I was thinking about when the White Stripes made Elephant. To a studio where they had only analogue... recording equipment.
Four tracks, isn't it?
I think it was four tracks and valve amps and things like that. This is the kind of sound they were looking for, I think. It's really warm and rich. And I think Richard Perry does a really, really great job the whole way through this. The arrangements are fantastic. And just the recording of the instruments, so it really punches.
Yeah, the instrumentation is kind of the croutons into the oxtail soup production. Some might say.
Oh, God.
Track three, Photograph.
This is a masterpiece, isn't it? This is such a great single. I think this might be in my top five Beatles solo singles. It's just wonderful. And it's a great song. And it's a Ringo George co-write. Though to me, it sounds more like George.
I think the thing about this is, I mean, it Don't Come Easy and Back Off Boogaloo were both produced by George, and he had no songwriting credit. I think after their success, I mean, this is the first time we get a Starkey Harrison composition credit. I think George was saying, come on, mate, I've helped you out enough here. And this is such a good song, I'm going to be on this one.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. And also, I think Don't Come Easy, there's a aspect of that that does sound very like George. There's a kind of Savoy Truffle tone in some of it. But this one in particular, the thing I think is, for me, is very distinctively George is... He seems really drawn to quite kind of jerky, awkward rhythms. You know, that Taxman is entirely constructed around this kind of slightly spasmodic rhythm. But, you know, if I needed someone to love, you're the one that I'd be thinking. That sort of thing. And so when you get the kind of... Every time I see your face, I'm reminded of the place. So the rhyme comes in slightly earlier than you're expecting it. That's the thing that says to me this is principally a George song. We also should talk about, I mean, the arrangement. The arrangement is the killer on this. And it's because it's, is it Jack? Now, how do you pronounce his name? Is it Nietzsche?
I always thought Nietzsche, but it's got to be Nietzsche. It can't be Nietzsche, surely.
Well, whichever. So Friedrich Nietzsche's arrangement on this, with all that kind of wall of sound feel that he brings with him, just means that the thing, it starts dramatically with that kind of jigga-ding and those guitars that sound like sitars, or are they actually sitars? I'm not quite sure.
It's 12-string guitars.
Right, so. Okay. And then it just, the instrumentation builds and builds and layers until the second half of the song is basically just going round and round and round, singing the same thing again. But it just feels more and more epic and beautiful. I just think this is an extraordinary, extraordinary song.
Mm. And again, George does something similar with the arrangement on If I Needed Someone. It starts and then it hits a plateau, which is it's sumptuous, rich plateau, but it stays there throughout the song. It doesn't build or sink. It just stays there. And it's such a lovely place to stay. And as you say, this is exquisite.
And it's also, throughout this record, I think you get a really, really vivid sense of how people understand Ringo, particularly the other Beatles. They really get Ringo and they write for him. Because one thing I love about this song is that George, I think, has, consciously or not, knows that Ringo has got this slightly lugubrious vocal tone. And so the rhythm has this slightly kind of dragging, sort of reluctant quality to it that actually really adds to the sense of kind of regret and sadness, while at the same time the music is being celebratory about sort of survival and loss. And I just think this is a wonderful song.
Lyrically as well, it's heartbreaking. Because after, obviously, George died, Ringo said this had a whole new meaning for him. And, you know, the lyrics, it's not just someone breaking up, it's someone they're never going to get back together. It's that real resigned feeling of, right, that's it.
Now you're expecting me.
Written in May 71. It was in a yacht in the south of France called the Marala.
Marala.
During the Cannes Film Festival. And Patti was there, Maureen was there, Cilla Black was there as well. And she wanted to do this. And Ringo, his actual quote was, "No, it's too bloody good for you. I'm having it myself." So thanks, Ringo, he saved us from that.
Bless him. Yeah, well, that's good. It's also the instrumentation is really unusual, and the more I listen to it, the more things I notice. The first time you get a big sort of instrumental break, you've got saxophone playing a solo and castanets, I think, in the background. I'm pretty sure is what you're getting. So again, it's evoking a very, very mixed musical landscape, but it seems to completely work, I think.
Oh, absolutely. And it was, again, another single, and it hit number one in the US.
That's right.
It's astonishing.
And the B-side is worth pointing out as well, Down and Out.
Yes.
Which is, that's a terrific song. I think it's just a Ringo star. Right, Down and Out really works, I think, as a song in its own right. I mean, it's not a particularly demanding song, but Photograph backed with Down and Out is a pretty classic single, I would say.
Yeah, great video as well, which was filmed in Ringo and Maureen's house, Tittenhurst Park. So that's a parallel with the Imagine video. Two videos filmed at Tittenhurst Park.
Right. Huh. No, I've never seen the video. What's the video like?
It's a bit like the Something video.
Okay.
Just him wandering around. Yeah. Four, Sunshine, Life for Me, brackets, Sail Away Raymond, close brackets.
It's another really good George Harrison song. And I mean, Living in the Material World, I think, is a really good record. But if there's anything you could fault it for, it's a bit serious. And I kind of think, wouldn't it have been lovely to have something like Sunshine, Life for Me on that, just to slightly enliven it a little bit. I mean, yeah. I don't want to criticize it. I actually prefer it to All Things Must Pass, but it's really nice that George shows a slightly more frivolous, flippant side. And the other thing as well, this really reminds me, I'm sure you've seen it many times, but you know that appearance he made on Rutland Weekend Television?
And
it's where
Pirate Song.
The Pirate Song. And he says early on in the episode that he doesn't want to be a pop star. He really wants to be a pirate. And George is really funny when he does that. He has this manic gleam in his eye. And then at the end, he's introduced as George Harrison. He's going to sing his, you know, My Sweet Lord. And they do the strumming introduction. And then he launches into, I want to be a pirate and sail the BBC. Yeah. And it sounds a bit like this. I mean, it's a sort of sea shanty, this song, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And again, what a lineup.
Oh, yeah. The band.
The band, basically. And David Bromberg, who previously worked with George on a song called The Hold Up, which is well worth digging out.
Okay, I don't think I know that. It's a weird song, isn't it? Because I think it's all on one chord the whole way through.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like a kind of reel, because all it's doing is, it's like it's driving out this sort of single chord, and it's the voice that's doing the up and down, which makes it sound like it's got a bit of a dance song thing to it.
There's a good life had at sea. If you're not in the Navy, that's a life for you. Sail away, Raymond, sail away. Woo!
Really get a strong sense of on this and sort of listening to these songs alongside Living in the Material World is that in a way Ringo brings out something a bit more sunny and playful in George that perhaps he doesn't find so easy if he's going to sing it himself. But he kind of, you know, there's a sort of real generosity, I think, in the songs that he's giving Ringo here, both in the act of giving the songs, but also in just the feel of the songs are just very open-hearted and even though Photograph is essentially a rather miserable song, the feel of it is actually, you know, about reconciliation and you know, getting over something. I mean, it's I think that's, I like what George, what happens to George when he's writing for Ringo.
Yeah, on paper, this is the same formula as Within You, Without You. One chord all the way through with the melody. So the difference when George is doing it seriously for himself, and then, as you say, when he gives it to Ringo, he's getting to real Ragmama rap.
It has got a little glimpse of that. I mean, the band are kind of wonderful on this, and the kind of vocals. Yeah. There's that point towards the end where it becomes almost like a canon, where the lines are kind of overlapping each other, which is kind of beautifully done and beautifully arranged. And it makes a song that is essentially a bit nothingy. I don't really know what this song is about, except a general expression of wanting a happier life. And I think I read somewhere that there may be another Beatles legal difficulties background to this.
Yeah.
But it turns it into something that is just so hugely enjoyable all the way through.
Well, Sail Away Raymond. Raymond was one of Alan Klein's lawyers.
Ah, so yes, right.
They'd obviously, Alan Klein's contract had finished. So Sail Away Raymond, it's like goodbye to all that legal crap.
Right.
Which George particularly hated.
Hmm.
So it's got a feeling of freedom.
Yes, and of course that's alongside, and because of that, that's why the Beatles are starting to not actually talk about reforming, but they're a bit more reconciled to each other, aren't they?
Absolutely, yeah. Huh. This was written by George, April 71, in an Easter holiday with Donovan. Donovan hasn't claimed any... anything with this, which is good.
What about Mike Love? Has Mike Love got claimed any involvement?
It was...
It's funny because even though I say that there's a kind of sunny side to this, that's in the music. I realise there are some lyrics in it that are very, very sour George. You know, most folks just bore me. Always imposing, I'd rather meet a tree. Oh dear, that's not a very good lyric. Somewhere out in a cornfield. I think that's the lyric.
Yeah.
But it's very the misanthropic side of George, I think. But he, fortunately, he embeds it in that very, very vertical up and down tune. And so I think the first sort of 10 times I listened to it, I just didn't really hear any of the lyrics. I was just propelled by that kind of dance rhythm.
And his vocals are very loud on, you know, very crystal clear on this. You can really hear George, particularly at that refrain at the
end.
Yes,
that's right. Yeah, absolutely.
Lovely to hear them together.
Yeah, that's right. Woo!
Final track on side one is a cover of the old Johnny Burnett song, You're 16.
So, just to get this out the way first, this is one of the creepiest songs ever written, isn't it? I mean, it's just terrible. It's a really weird, creepy sexualization of a young girl. And... I mean, even the bit, the line, you came out of my dreams and into my car, it just sounds like he's abducting her, you know, and also it's not as if you kind of go, well, actually, you know, 16, that's okay. It's, you're all ribbons and curls. Oh, what a girl. This is a really unpleasant song about underage girls. And I was then thinking, there was an awful lot of that around in the 60s, well, I suppose there's still is, but you know that Gary Puckett song, Young Girl.
Oh, I was going to say I heard that on the radio the other day, and it's just every line gets worse and worse.
It really does. I'm amazed they still play that. Actually, I must say, but you know, there's, you know, Little Sister, Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon. I mean, there's a lot of those awful songs. So anyway, I wanted to say that. Because
we can't blame Ringo for that.
Can't blame Ringo for that. But, and also, actually, I think he does a really great version of it here. Mm. Again, I think the arrangement is wonderful. I initially thought, because I'm an idiot, that it was Paul and Linda doing the backing vocals, but it's all Harry Nilsson, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're beautiful. I mean, there's that sort of doo-wop thing, and he does it absolutely immaculately. God, he had such a beautiful voice, didn't he?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so actually, and again, I think the persona that Ringo has makes this feel harmless, you know, rather than creepy. A 33-year-old man singing about a 16-year-old girl. I think it works really, really well, this arrangement and this version. And it's got Paul on it.
Yeah, Paul's on kazoo.
Oh, is that right? That's interesting because I was listening. I was trying to hear for vocals because I knew he was supposed to be on it somewhere, but I couldn't hear him. And then is that a kazoo?
Yeah.
Oh right, okay.
What else would it be?
Yeah, you know, I'll have a go at the kazoo. I'll play kazoo on this. Yeah.
I'll play kazoo if you want, or I won't. But again, another massive hit single. So
that's right.
Didn't keep out the charts at this time.
It's amazing. I suppose this is there is a big kind of rock and roll revival thing. Is that around? That's about this time, isn't it? And I suppose he's kind of slightly playing into. I mean, the whole record actually has got. Well, there's a lot of sort of quite rock and roll type sounds on it, and I suppose he's able to kind of tap into that feeling at the time, which I guess is lots of people who were sort of 18 in the late 50s, who now 15 years later are making decisions in record companies and movie studios, so they're mining their childhood for stuff. But yeah, I think this is kind of fine. I mean, it's interesting that Ringo has this ordinary nice guy image, but it's around this time that he starts to slightly threaten that by becoming a bit of a drunken arsehole, doesn't he?
I definitely recommend a book, Moon the Loom, by Dougal Butler, which gives you real insight to the friendships at this time with Ringo and Harry Nilsson and all that crowd. And, yeah, they were living the life, I think.
Right, yeah.
The chaos really kicked in with the Pussycats recording sessions, but these are obviously before that, so there's still a... I don't think there's quite as much cocaine around at this particular time.
Okay. I just think we've kind of noticed already on this record that quite a lot of it kind of only works if you sort of already have a view of Ringo as being this nice, ordinary, kind of sweet guy. But, you know, I think the more we think of him as being the kind of rich, pampered, drunken idiot who's always being thrown out of nightclubs, the less this kind of approach to an album is going to work. I sound very judgmental there, but but actually I think it's kind of in the texture of this album that I'm the Greatest works if you think he's a nice guy and not an arrogant idiot. I think, you know, Have You Seen My Baby works if you think he's a sort of everyman ordinary guy. I think You're 16 works if you don't think he's a creepy womanizer. You know, so it's a complicated time for Ringo this period.
It is.
Didn't Ringo propose to make a film called something like Harry and Ringo's Big Night Out, which was going to be the great spectacle of a camera crew following them on a kind of pub crawl over the course of a week? Oh, wow.
That would have been so amazing.
What a terrible idea.
So flipping over to side two, and we start with Oh My My, which was co-written by songwriter Vinnie Poncia, who Ringo continued to write with for several more albums. Notably, Vinnie later went on to produce the 1978 album Portrait by Linda Carter, a.k.a. Wonder Woman.
And also, Vinnie Poncia, is that how we're pronouncing his name?
Dan, your surname's Rebelato. I'm relying on you here.
Well, Vinnie Poncia, his first recorded song, weirdly, was Ringo, I Love You, for Cher.
Oh, yeah.
So how weird that his first song is Ringo, I Love You, and he ends up writing for Ringo. I wonder if that caused some awkward moments in the collaboration. But Oh My My, I really like this. I think this is a really good fun song. It's not pretending to do anything that it isn't doing. So it's a novelty song in a way, but then it's in that tradition, that sort of weird 70s tradition of commanding people to dance, you know, get down tonight, dance yeah. to the music, you should be dancing, those sorts of things. And, you know, and actually, yeah. I think it's a pretty good song. It doesn't. This is the one that's got Mary Clayton and Martha Reeves on it. I don't think it needs incredible singers like Mary Clayton and Martha Reeves on this. So that's quite odd. But it's really it's great fun.
Yeah, to be fair, I think they are carrying it. Without them on the mix, I don't think it would be quite the same song. Mary Clayton in particular, there's that isolated vocal of her singing Gimme Shelter.
Oh, I know. Oh. That's incredible. It's just a shadow wave. It's just a shadow wave. Rape murder. Yeah. It's just a shadow wave. It's just a shadow wave. Rape murder. It's just a shadow wave. It's just a shadow wave. Yeah, 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 yeah. Those vocals. I mean, she.
Did they just wake her up in the middle of the night, didn't they? I seem to remember during the session saying, we want you to come to the studio. And she literally got out of bed with her rollers in her hair and just did it.
And wow. and of course, it's just the hairs on the back of your neck. I mean, she's an incredible singer. I would say a little bit wasted on this one. But there's, you know, there's nothing wrong with this. I think this is fun. I was listening to this record this morning and went out for a run. And of all the songs on this record, this is the one that put a spring in my step. So for that alone, I can recommend Oh My My.
This was released as a single as well, only in the US. Ah. And John sent Star a telegram saying, congratulations, how dare you, and please write me a hit song. She's lovely.
That's right. Well, actually, because John was, if Ringo was the most consistently high-charting Beatle, John is kind of the least successful Beatle at the time. Which is weird to think, given that, you know, how sort of venerated he rightly is. But actually, his, I think possibly because he's moved to the US, so he's got less of a profile in Britain, and maybe there's a sense he's abandoned, I don't know. But no, people weren't really buying his singles or his albums at the time, which is weird.
Step lightly. You're moving too fast. Take your time, boy. Soon the pain will pass. In the meantime, you gotta find yourself a love that's gonna last.
Track 2, featuring the dancing feet of Richard Starkey, MBE, Step Lightly.
So this is a charming song, I think. It's kind of undemanding, but it's actually, it's a perfectly decent lyric. I think it's a sweet little tune. It's a nice sentiment. As you say, it features the dancing feet. Richard Starkey, it's an odd moment when this sort of Shetland pony galumphs across the stereo mix, but you know, I think it's fine. And again, the arrangement is really nice. Is that, I think there's a sort of, is it a bass clarinet or something that you can hear in it?
It is, yeah.
And it has a kind of, you know, it has that lovely kind of smoky feel to it. It reminds me of, do you know Pearl's a Singer by Elky Brooks? Because it's got that da-da-da-da. Which I think was only a year or so afterwards. It's a similar sort of feel and arrangement to it. So I think, again, this is one that it's sort of, it's a bit of nothing in a way, but somehow the taste of the arranger and the producer, and actually how Ringo chooses to sing it, means it just, it really works. It's interesting. I think that I listened to this record a couple of days ago, just thinking about vocal range. And I realized that almost every song on this record, you can sing within one octave, because obviously Ringo doesn't have an amazing range. Not that there's anything wrong with that, of course. John Lennon often sung within quite a kind of narrow range. But this, it's really interesting. This, I think, has the narrowest vocal range. And it's the one that Ringo's entirely written himself.
Yeah.
But of course,
it's the only self-composed song.
Exactly. And in a way, you go, that's kind of clever. He's picking songs that he's drawn kind of probably instinctively to going, oh yeah, I think I could sing that one. And other people are writing songs for him that are designed to be sort of Ringo-sized in terms of their vocal demands.
Yeah. Well, George Martin said that, didn't he, about Paul's A Little Help From My Friends. In fact, the melody was only based around five notes. So it was perfect for Ringo.
Yeah. Well, in fact, that takes us very neatly, doesn't it, to 6 o'clock.
Six o'clock in the morning, you've just gone to sleep. I wipe a tear from my eye. You can't be the kind of company I keep. That keeps me asking, you keep me asking, you keep me wondering why. I like to treat you. Every planet in the sky is in your eyes, but I don't treat you like I. No, I don't treat you like I. No, I don't treat you like I should.
Track 3, 6 o'clock.
Sorry, I was actually sitting there expecting to hear the clip. What an idiot.
All right, yeah. If you give me half an hour, I'll put the computer on.
Yeah, so I like this. I don't love this, but I really like this. And that's weird for me because, you know, I love a classic McCartney piano ballad me. And I was trying to sort of figure out why is it that I can't completely give myself to loving this song. I think it feels a little bit marooned on the record. I don't know what you think, but it doesn't feel like the rest of the record. But then partly because of Step Lightly as a transition, I quite like the fact it gives a bit of variety to the song. But I think for me, it doesn't quite lift off. And I think the reason why I have a theory to explain why I don't think it quite works. It's because McCartney is all about soaring melody lines that kind of ascend the scale and get kind of higher and more grand and sweeping. Maybe I'm Amazed, Here, There and Everywhere, For No One, Live and Let Die, Wanderlust. They all kind of do that thing. And he knows that that's not going to work for Ringo, because he doesn't have the range to be able to. He couldn't sing Live and Let Die, for example. So I think what he does is, I think he does the same trick he does with A Little Help From My Friends, which is he structures it around a descending bass line that is basically every time McCartney's instinct is for the tune to go up, the descending bass line is kind of pulling the melody down.
Yeah.
And of course, with A Little Help From My Friends, that works perfectly because it's a very conversational type song. And so, you know, you've got the kind of dum, 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 dum thing going down. And Ringo appears to be kind of soaring, even though he's singing on a monotone pretty much. But I sort of feel with this one, because this is a much more dramatic song and it properly is a ballad, it feels like it really wants to soar. But the point when we get to the chorus, which I think if McCartney were writing this for himself, he would have let rip, it just feels like you get the kind of every diamond in the sky is the point when you think that's where he's about to take flight.
Yeah.
But then that descending bass line kind of chugs in again. And so you just get the kind of melody repeated going down the scale. And so I just feel like it's kind of Icarus song that is trying to kind of fly to the sun, but just doesn't quite do it. Don't know. What do you think of this?
I love the Icarus thing. Yeah. I think you've summed it up perfectly. I can't add anything. It just doesn't soar when it would. As you say, if Paul was doing this on his own, the chorus would be a different melody, I think.
Mm.
And it's just,
yeah,
just following the bass line. I do love the end, though. I think it does kind of build up on the, I don't treat you like I. There's something lovely hearing Paul and Ringo together, a bit like the end of Beautiful Nights.
Yes, yeah, that's certainly true. Yeah,
just a flavour of Beatles, but
that's right.
A song,
I think I suppose I quite like some of the lyrics. I quite like those moments where Paul is not being entirely sweetness and light, and is a bit like Cage, which I think we may have talked about last time. You know, those expressions of regret that actually he's a flawed person, and it's not just all kind of love will conquer all. So I think there's something potentially good in the song. I sort of feel like because there's the album is this whole album is so tantalizing us with a Beatles reunion, I just kind of think if John Lennon were there to hear the song and just suggest a few little caustic touches, that would have really improved the song. I think the Beatles' arrangement would have made this a much more powerful song. I think probably we wouldn't have that clunky little synthesizer thing that comes in. I think it's fine, but it's not my favourite.
Move on to the lyrical wonderland of Devil Woman.
Oh, God. This...
This is another Ringo, a Vinnie Poncia composition.
Yeah, this is absolutely the weakest song on the record, for me, anyway. I mean, musically, this is where I feel like we're in pastiche territory. It sounds like when ELO do rock and roll songs. You know, like Rama Lama Lama Lama, Rock and Roll is King, that sort of thing. It's got that kind of slightly overproduced. Even though it isn't actually overproduced, it's just a little bit too on the nose somehow. And then, the lyrics. I mean, dear Lord.
Not something you put on a Valentine's card.
No, it's like, I kind of think if you were teaching a course on post-war male sexuality in popular culture, and I'm sure lots of people are, you know, I think you could set this because I'm always quite interested in songs that are really misogynistic, but they're not just subtly misogynistic in a way that, I mean, some Rolling Stones songs are absolutely out there misogynistic, but quite a lot of them are just creepily misogynistic, but you know, I used to joke, you know, that somebody once said that if Dublin were ever razed to the ground, you could rebuild it stone by stone through James Joyce's Ulysses. And I used to say that if masculinity were ever removed from the earth, you could rebuild it by listening to You'll Think of Me by Elvis Presley. But I think you could do that. You could do that with this song as well, because the sequence of thoughts in this song seems to be, if I've got this right, number one, there's a sexy woman. Two, she is unspeakably pure evil. Three, the only way I can overcome her evil is by doing sex on her. And you think, that is, it's sort of fascinating to see that kind of weird misogyny laid so bare in such a kind of crass way. And, you know, and a namesake song, of course, Cliff Richard's Devil Woman from a couple of years later, you kind of think, well, at least in that song, I mean, it's still a misogynistic song, but at least in that song, he's had a relationship with this woman.
You know, there's an emotion, a bit more emotion than this one.
That's right. You know, and also, I think because Cliff Richard, you know, is a Christian, there's a sort of theological heft to talking about a devil woman. There's 2,000 years of Pauline Christianity. But in this one, he's just seen her. She's just walking down the street. That's all that's happened. This poor woman, because of the sin of having long legs, she's been described as a devil with horns on her head.
And her eyes are green, don't forget that.
And her eyes are green. I know, the whore. And and then the other thing is, okay, so in Getting Better by the Beatles, we have the I used to be cruel to my woman, I beat her and kept her apart from things I love. It's an expression of regret, okay? It's not a good thing, but there's in the past I did bad things. In Run For Your Life by the Beatles, which is a terrible song, but, you know, at least it's presenting jealous feelings and there's a threat there. In this song, he sings about this woman that he's only seen. I want to beat you up and then I want to be kind. He wants to do this. This is his ideal relationship. I mean, oh, man. Yeah. This is a terrible song. Terrible song. There's nothing good about it, really, is there?
No, nothing.
I don't know what Vinnie Poncia was doing on this one.
Yeah, who do we blame? Do we blame
I know.
The Italian Stallion, or do we blame Ringo? But yeah, I think, let's move on.
For you and me.
We end on, for me, my favourite track on the album, You and Me, Babe, which is a Mal Evans and George Harrison co-write.
I love this. This is just superb, isn't it? The melody is beautiful, lilting. It's a moving song. It's got a lovely little sort of quite soulful little groove to it. But it's got that kind of finger snapping late night feel, and it's very clever, you know. It's a bit like, you know, in Sgt. Pepper, the sort of idea was, we're not touring anymore, so we'll put a tour on vinyl. And this one is sort of, in a way, it's sort of also exploring what a vinyl record is like by kind of treating it like a short dalliance, you know, that we've spent a little time together and now it's over. But it doesn't try and build that into a massive metaphor. It just makes it a really playful song. It's, you know, again, I think this is a brilliant example of George finding the most generous side of himself in writing this song for Ringo to sing. So it's, I just think this is lovely. I'm a real earworm and should be a much better known song, I think. And then, of course, the ending is delightful. Oh. You know, as he says, he says his thanks. And don't you always get a little crackle of excitement when he mentions the other Beatles? It's just a lovely little moment.
Well, it's the end of the night. I'd just like to say thank you to everyone involved with this piece of plastic we're making. Good old Jim Kelfer, Klaus Voormann, Nicky Hopkins, George Harrison, John Lennon, Paul McCartney, Richard Perry for producing this masterpiece, Bill Schnee, ever smiling, ever welcome, Vinnie Poncediro, and all his other friends, and everyone else who joined in and helped us on this wonderful record. So it's a big good night from your friend and mine, Ringo Starr.
And the order he says them, George first, then John, then Paul.
Yep, exactly. Yep.
Well, read into that what you want. Don't know.
And again, it's that thing of, you know, when he ends his litany, sort of, so that's goodbye from your friend of mine, Ringo Starr. And you go, yeah, actually, this is what the record has achieved, but also kind of relies on, is that, yeah, you do kind of think Ringo Starr is just a kind of lovely guy. And it, at that point, you go, yeah, he's completely pulled that off. Because, you know, if there was anything apart from Devil Woman, when they talk about, that makes you not like Ringo about this record, then that ending would be a real damn squib. But actually, it's such a warm, loving record. I think it just works really, really well.
Again, that meta moment. Oh, I may not be in your town, know that I can still be here. Right here on this record, spinning round. That is just so beautiful. I remember hearing, I had it on cassette, oddly, first time I heard it, and I was just gutted I didn't have the vinyl at the time. But for me, the moment is the when he sings, the violin stayed to wish you good night, and the strings just appear for the first time. It's so beautifully constructed.
Yeah, it's lovely. It's really lovely. I think the melody is very... I think it's quite Paul McCartney, the feel of the song. Mm. But I think Paul would be much less likely to be meta in the way that George allows it to be. I presume it's George. I don't know what Mal Evans did on this.
Well, I think Mal Evans did the lyrics.
Oh, and is that right?
George, Mal had what he termed a meditation song and asked George to help with the melody. So, and we were talking about it before, Mal Evans, when he used to write in the Beatles Monthly book, he would often veer into quite thoughtful, you know, be reviewing an album or what the boys have been up to, but he would always, you know, and life can be like that sometimes, you know, he's a very thoughtful person, so, and a very witty person as well, so, yeah, maybe.
Yeah, I think this is just lovely, really, really, really lovely, lovely song. And it's your favourite on the record?
It is, yeah, and I have no idea why. It's not definitely not the strongest, you know, photograph, but it's just having it there at the end. I kind of wish this had ended Sergeant Pepper in a way. Actually, no, forget that. I've completely forgot A Day in the Life. But in an alternate universe, it would have been a nice Sergeant Pepper ending. It would have made more sense.
Well, I do
think Sergeant Pepper reprise, maybe.
I do think, you know, because I think this album, this must be a roughly contemporary with the Red and Blue records.
Yeah.
And you know, people always kind of do, what would a Green record, you know, what would 70 to 75 be? And this would be the last song. You'd have to make this the last song on a double album of solo Beatles stuff. It's really beautiful. I think it's great.
It is. And before we sum up, we've got to mention the vinyl, which, with the gatefold sleeve, 24-page booklet, and illustrations from Klaus Voormann, and artwork by Tim Bruckner, who did an amazing... you know, it's very Pepper, but he was saying... oh, I've wiped my notes. Shit, hold on. I spent ages typing all that out. Oh, okay, don't worry. But, yeah, so, and you've got everybody in there from, everybody who's performing on the record, even Martha, Paul's dog, is on the cover. But it's, as a whole package, it's fantastic, isn't it? It's just real evocative Pepper, really, for me.
Yeah, I think it's lovely. And it also, it's a pretty short album. It doesn't outstay its welcome at all. So I think it's just really well, really well judged.
The phrase on the cover, there's the mock Latin, do it on Monday, was a favourite phrase of Harry Nilsson.
Oh, right.
He used it for his 75 album. So, Dan, overall, what does this almost Beatles album mean to you?
Well, I really like this record. I really like it. But I was thinking, would I recommend it to a music fan friend of mine? And I don't know, and the reason I don't know is that I sort of feel like that it's, you kind of need to be a bit immersed in the Beatles, because it feels like it's so drawing on that shared history with the other guys. And it's quoting, you know, we get Sexy Sadie mentioned in Devil Woman, and there are musical references and stuff like that. That I kind of was asking myself, does it actually sort of stand alone? And then I found myself going, well, actually, but in a way, we're all immersed in the Beatles, whether we know it or not. So probably I would kind of recommend it in that way. But I think there's a really interesting question about what you're listening to when you listen to this record, because Ringo's an odd proposition, isn't he? You know, if you think of a new Ringo Starr album, what do you want from that? Because it's not as if you're kind of, what's old Golden Tonsils gonna delight us with this time? You know, he's obviously not the world's greatest vocalist, though I think that can be overdone, but you know, he's not the world's greatest vocalist. He's not really much of a songwriter. He's not that much of a musician outside being a drummer. And actually, I presume he's drumming all the way through this, but despite everything I said before about how distinctive
his... all the way through, no.
Okay, well, I don't recognize his drumming on this as much as I do on the other things that I mentioned. So he's not the producer, he's not the arranger, he's not the songwriter. The singing is not what you're particularly going for. I don't even know whether you would say he kind of came up with the feel of the record. That probably is more Richard Perry. But what he brings is just his Ringo-ness. And I think somehow it becomes a kind of magic ingredient that really just makes this such an enjoyable listen. And then, of course, but he's done it on Ringo. And then I think there's probably a slight sense of diminishing returns from that kind of proposition as it goes on. I realized in the last couple of days, just sort of thinking about this discussion, that I don't, whereas I've got a very strong sense of the kind of story of George Harrison and the story of Paul McCartney and the story of John Lennon, I kind of really don't have a sense of Ringo's story. And, you know, if I'm honest, even though I think I'm quite a big Beatles fan, I know he's released a lot of albums in the last 30 years. I've rarely listened to a single one of them. I'd quite like to read his autobiography if he were to write one. I think Ringo would probably quite like to read his autobiography. The chapter from 1975 to 1985 would probably be fascinating to. But, you know, I sort of feel like there's I don't know what the story is behind it and what actually drives him to keep making the music. But I feel like on Ringo, you get a moment of real clarity where he just creates this wonderful persona and allows music to kind of accumulate around it in a way that is just joyful.
Absolutely. Dan Rebeletto, thank you so much.
Cheers. Thanks, Chris.